Okie dokie, today we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about biostats. Okay, so we're going to start off with observational studies. So there are 7 different types of observational studies. The first type is a case series. The case series describes individual patients with the same diagnosis, treatment, or outcome. It describes clinical findings. There is no comparison group, so you can't show risk factor association with the disease. The next type is cross-sectional. This studies present day. It is present day assessment of frequency of disease and frequency of risk factor. It shows disease prevalences. It can show risk factor association with disease, but it cannot establish causality. The next is a case control study. This is retrospective. It compares people with the disease versus without, and it looks to see if odds of prior exposure of risk factors differ by disease state. This measures odds ratio. Example, patient with COPD had higher odds of smoking than a non-COPD patient. And first aid says you control the case in the OR. So case control is odds ratio. The next type is a cohort study. This compares group with exposure versus without exposure. Sees if exposure is associated with later disease development. It can be prospective or retrospective, but the risk factor must be present prior to the disease onset. It measures incidence, and relative risk, or RR. For example, people who smoke have higher risks of developing COPD. So the risk factor had to be present before the disease onset. They had to smoke before they developed COPD. So first aid remembers that cohort has 2 O's and then risk, relative risk has 2 R's. So it's double snake eyes. It's OO for RR. The next type is twin concordance. This compares frequencies with which mono twins versus di twins develop the same disease. It measures nature versus nurture. Next is adoption study. This compares traits / genetics in siblings raised by bio versus adopted parents. It measures nature versus nurture as well. The last type is the ecological study. It compares disease frequency and the frequency of risk factors across populations, and it measures the population of the health. For example, COPD increases in high pollution cities. Okay, the second kind of broad category other than observational studies is a clinical therapeutic trial. The crossover clinical trial compares 2 or more treatments on 1 subject. Order in which patient receives is randomized and separated by a washout period. It allows the subject to be their own control. So I'll repeat that. A crossover clinical trial compares 2 or more treatments on 1 subject. Order in which patient receives treatment is randomized and separated with a washout period. It lets you be your own control. This would be like me having sertraline and then getting switched to Wellbutrin. Deadass. Intent to treat analysis. Now I'm just talking about biostats. I'm not talking about specific things. Intent to treat analysis. Subjects are analyzed according to their original assigned treatment. No one is excluded. The intent to treat analysis is used to avoid bias from attrition, crossover, non-random compliance. It might dilute the true effects of the intervention, though. But, like, we still do it. So don't leave anybody out. Leave them in their original group. The next is as-treated analysis. As-treated analysis means that we analyze according to treatment actually received. This runs an increased risk of bias. And then the third type of analysis is per protocol analysis. In this, the subjects who failed to improve, per protocol analysis, subjects who fail to complete the treatment are excluded. Problem is, this also increases the risk of bias. Okay, the stages of therapeutic trials. First, we have stage zero, so preclinical. Did I lie? Okay, so stages. Preclinical. Preclinical is on animals or in vitro. If that passes, it goes to phase zero. Phase zero, you study the pharmacokinetics with microdoses. Phase zero is often skipped. Okay, next is phase one. Phase one is in which you assess safety in a small amount of healthy people or with the disease. It is open label. Next is phase two. This is where you assess the efficacy and the short-term adverse side effects in a moderate number of people with the disease. It is randomized and controlled. Then you move on to phase three. That is where you compare with the current standard or placebo in large groups of people with the disease. It is also random and controlled. After phase three, the drug will go on market and transition into phase four. Phase four asks the question, can I stay on the market? It does long-term / rare adverse side effects. Okay, talking about some more words. Bradford Hill criteria. A group of principles that provide limited support for establishing evidence of a causal relationship between presumed cause and effect. I don't know what the fuck that means. Oh my gosh. Oh. We're just talking about principles. Okay, so all of the following are part of the Bradford Hill criteria. Strength, consistency, specificity, temporality, biological gradient, plausibility, coherence, experiment, and analogy. I'm going to read each one of those, what they mean. Okay, strength. Association does not necessarily imply causation, but the stronger the association, the more evidence for causation. Next is consistency. Repeated observations of the finding in multiple distinct samples. Specificity. The more specific the presumed case is to the effect, the stronger the evidence for causation. Temporality. The presumed cause precedes the effect by an expected amount of time. Biological gradient. Greater effect observed with greater exposure to the presumed cause, aka a dose-response relationship. Plausibility. A conceivable mechanism exists by which the cause may lead to the effect. Coherence. The presumed cause and effect do not conflict with existing scientific consensus. Experiment. Empirical evidence supporting the presumed cause and effect. Analogy. The presumed cause and effect are comparable to similar established cause and effects. Okay. On to the math. So risk analysis. We're talking about risk analysis. First, we're going to talk about the odds ratio. Where have we heard that? In case control studies, you control the OR. So the odds ratio is the odds of exposure among cases versus the odds of exposure among controls over non-disease. Sorry. I'm going to reread that. So the odds ratio. It is in case control studies. It's odds of exposure among cases. So exposed plus disease over no exposed plus disease versus the odds of exposure amongst controls / non-diseased. Yeah. So, oh my God, I'm crashing out. Okay, so the odds ratio. The first number in the ratio is exposed plus with the disease over no exposed with the disease. Then the second number in the ratio is exposed without disease over not exposed without the disease. Fucking Christ. If the odds ratio is 1, the odds of exposure are equal in each group. If odds ratio is over 1, odds of exposure is increased in disease. If odds ratio is under 1, odds are greater in the control. Next, relative risk. Okay, relative risk is typically used in cohort studies. It is risk of developing disease in exposed over risk of developing disease in unexposed. So you do exposed with disease over total with exposed. Exposed with disease over total exposed. That's your top number. Your bottom number is no exposed with disease and total without exposure. Jesus fucking Christ. For rare diseases, the OR approximates the RR. If the RR is equal to 1, there is no association between exposure and disease. If the RR is over 1, then exposure equals increased disease risk. If RR is under 1, exposure equals decreased disease risk. Next is the relative risk reduction. Relative risk reduction due to intervention versus control. For RRR, we do 1 minus RR. For example, if 2% of people with the flu shot get the flu, and 8% of unvaccinated people get the flu, RR is 2 over 8, so 0.25, and then RRR would be 0.75. Deadass, I guess. Okay, and RR, because if 2% of people with the flu shot get the flu, and that is exposed with disease, over... I don't know. Okay, next is attributable risk. Attributable risk is risk in exposed minus risk in unexposed. If the risk is, I don't know, man. Oh, if risk of lung cancer is 21% in smokers and 1% in non-smokers, the attributable risk is 20%. Nice. Okay, so, So, attributable risk is, let's see, it is with the disease with exposure over with disease with exposure plus with exposure without disease minus no exposure, yes disease, over no exposure, yes disease, plus no exposure, no disease. What even? Next is attributable risk. That is the risk in exposed minus the risk in unexposed. Oh, wait, I just did that. Next is the absolute risk reduction. This is the difference in risk attributed to intervention. Example, if 8% of people who without vaccination get virus versus 2% with vaccination get virus, absolute risk reduction is 8 minus 2 equals 6. Okay, yeah. So if 8% of people without the vaccine get the virus, and 2% with the vaccine get the virus, you do 8 minus 2. Next, number needed to treat. Number needed to treat is 1 over absolute risk reduction. And number needed to harm is 1 over absolute risk. Attributable risk. Jesus, that was fucking horrible. I'm going to have to listen to that like 15,000 times. Diagnostic tests. I can't even... Okay, I guess I can. Likelihood ratio. Okay, likelihood ratio is probability of positive result in patient with disorder over probability of positive result in patient without disorder. This is sensitivity over 1 minus specificity. That's fucking balls, dude. What? Test effect. efficiency? Test efficiency? Bro, I don't even know. Okay, how to do sensitivity. Sensitivity is the ability to detect the presence of disease. It is good at ruling out diseases. It is good for screening. High sensitivity equals increased high true positive and low false negatives. So how do we find sensitivity? We do true positive over true positive plus false negative. All of them have the disease. Or we can do 1 minus the false negative rate. Specificity is the ability to detect the absence of the disease. It is good at ruling in disease, and it is the confirmation test after the screening. Okay, so a high specificity equals a high true negative, which is a low false positive. How do we find specificity? True negative over true negative plus false positive, or 1 minus false positive rate. Positive predictive value is the probability that a positive test actually predicts the disease correctly. So a positive predictor value is probability that a positive test actually predicts the disease. So PPV equals true positive over true positive plus false positive. Negative predictive value is the probability that a negative test actually predicts it correctly. Negative predictive value equals true negative over true negative plus false negative. So in these ones, they all have the same like letter. So like negative predictive value, it's TN over TN plus FN. And then positive predictor value is TP over TP plus FP, and they all have P in it. So I like to think of it as the positive predicting, there's two Ps. So all of my factors are going to have P's in them. And that's how I tell it apart from like the sensitivity and specificity. Okay, receiver operating characteristic curve. Precision versus accuracy. Precision is reliability plus reproducibility. It decreases random variability. High precision has low standard deviation and high statistical power. Low precision increases random error. Accuracy. Accuracy is validity. It is how close results are to the true value. It has absence of bias. Systematic errors decrease accuracy. Okay, incidence versus prevalence. Incidence is the number of new cases divided by number of people at risk. So incidence looks at new cases, the incidence. Prevalence is the number of cases over the total number of people in the population. Prevalence looks at all current cases. Nice. Okay, per. Biases. Oh my god. Okay, biases. So, when recruiting participants, what biases can we do? 1. Selection bias. This is non-random selection or treatment allocation so that the study population isn't representative of the target population. It is the most common. Oh, the most common is sampling bias. Okay. 1. Convenience sampling. That means we enroll patients on basis of ease of contact. 2 is the Berkson bias. That is cases and or controls are selected from hospitals. But the problem with that is that they're less healthy and they have more exposures. So first aid remembers that Berkson bias is bedside bias. So we're picking people from hospitals and like that's low-key not going to be good. Next is attrition bias. Attrition bias is the patient lost to follow-up have different prognosis than those who complete the study. How to decrease selection bias. Randomize, ensure choice of right comparison / reference group. Okay, that's what we can do before the study. What biases can we commit during the study? 1 is recall bias. This is the awareness of disease alters subject recall. It's common in retrospective studies. how to prevent it, decrease time from exposure. Decrease the time from exposure to the follow-up. Use medical records as sources. 2, what is the next bias we can commit? It is measurement bias. That is info gathered in systematically disorganized or disordered ways. For example, using faulty automatic blood pressure machines. A subset of measurement bias is the Hawthorne effect, in which the patient is aware of observation, so they change their behavior. How do we prevent measurement bias? We use objective, standard, previously tested methods of data collection. We use placebo groups. Next is procedure bias. Procedure bias is subjects in different groups are treated differently. And then next is observer expectancy bias. This is when researchers believe of efficacy and that impacts the outcome, like what you measure. It's the observer's expectancy. To prevent procedure bias and observation expectancy bias, do double-blind studies. The observer expectancy bias is also called the Pygmalion effect. And it's pretty much if you expect one group to do better, you're going to make them, like, do better. You know, like, you're going to write that they did better. Anyways, interpreting results is the next part where we can commit bias. So we can commit the lead time bias. That's where mistakenly early detection is interpreted as increased survival. How to prevent lead time bias is we measure back into survival. So we adjust survival according to the disease severity at the diagnosis time. The next is length time bias. That is when screening test detects disease with a long latency period, while those with shorter latency periods become symptomatic earlier. For example, a slower cancer is more likely to be detected by screening than a fast one. So that would be length time bias. Next is, we're done with biases, yay. Next is confounding factors versus effect modifications. Confounding effect is factors related to exposure and outcome distort effects on the outcome. There's no association after stratification. Example, coffee seems linked to cancer, but smoking is the true cause because coffee drinkers are more likely to smoke. How do we prevent confounding effects? We do crossover studies. We match patients with similar characteristics in both groups. And we can also do regression analysis. Next is effect modification. So effect modification is when exposure leads to different outcomes in subgroups stratified by factors. In effect modification, a true association exists. For example, OCP use increases the risk of DVT. And then when the patients were stratified by smoking habit, So OCP risk increased risk of DVT. Then they stratified the patients by smoking habit, and they found that there is a DVT risk in smokers, but not in non-smokers. So the exposure led to different outcomes in subgroups stratified by that factor, the factor of smoking. How do you prevent effect modification? You stratify. Deadass. Nice. Okay. Testing errors. What kind of errors can we commit? A type 1 error. A type 1 error is we say there's a difference when there isn't. Alpha is the probability of making a type 1 error. Most studies accept an alpha value of 0.05. This is the false positive error. If P is under alpha, so if the P is lower than 0.05, the probability of getting a test result less than probability of making... probability of getting test result is less than probability of making a type 1 error. So, like, that just means, like, there's probably a difference. Type 2 error, which is a beta error, is saying that there is no difference when there is one. It is a false negative error. High sample sizes increase power, which decreases type 2 errors. Okay, purr. Okay. Next is confidence intervals. This is the range of values in which the true mean is expected to fall. Okay, so confidence interval 1 minus alpha. As number increases, confidence interval decreases. So that just means as number increases, we get more confident about the true mean. Okay. Null hypothesis is rejected if the confidence interval for the mean difference excludes zero or is between two groups that don't overlap, or if confidence interval excludes one. What the fuck, man? Huh, how interesting. Okay. Null hypothesis is rejected if CI for mean difference excludes zero, or CI is between two groups that don't overlap, or if CI, OR, or RR excludes one. The null hypothesis is accepted if the CI for mean difference includes zero, if CI is between two groups do overlap, or if CI, OR, or RR includes one. Fuck, man. So, the gist is, the null hypothesis is rejected if CI for mean difference excludes zero, CI is between two groups don't overlap, or if CI, OR, or RR excludes one. We're kicking it out. We're kicking it out. We're rejecting the null hypothesis. Exclude, exclude, exclude. We accept the null hypothesis if the CI includes zero, if two groups overlap, or if CI, OR, or RR includes one. We include it. We accept the null hypothesis. Okay. Meta-analysis. Meta-analysis pools summary data from multiple studies. It provides a more precise estimate of size and effect. It increased power and strength of evidence, plus generalizability, aka external validation. Meta-analysis is limited by the number of studies, plus bias in every study selection. Statistical tests. Okay. Common statistical tests. There's the t-test. The t-test measures the difference between the means of two groups. They write t is meant for two, and meant, they highlighted mean. This would be like comparing the mean blood pressure between men and women. ANOVA. The ANOVA test checks differences between means of three or more groups. Three words, analysis of variance. That's what ANOVA means. For example, comparing the mean blood pressure between members of three different ethnic groups. The next is the chi-squared test. This checks difference between two or more percentages or proportions of categorical outcomes, not mean values. It is pronounced chi-torical. Oh, categorical. Chi-tagorical. Categorical, chi-tagorical. Okay. Example is comparing the proportion of members of three age groups who have essential hypertension. So you're using, like, categorical outcomes. I guess, like, yes or no. Perhaps. And then there's the Fisher's exact test. The Fisher's exact test checks differences between two percentages or proportions of categorical nominal outcomes. Use it instead of a chi-square test with small samples. Example, comparing the percentage of 20 men and 20 women with hypertension. Okay. Oh, so there's this little chart. Variables to be compared. If they are numerical, meaning they're numbers. If they are means. If there are two groups, you do a t-test. If there are over three groups, you do an ANOVA. If Your variables to be compared are categorical or proportional, like proportions. If it's a small sample size, you do Fisher's exact. If it's a large sample size, you do a chi-squared test or a chi-squared. I don't know. Chi-tagorical. Maybe that would make more sense. Next is the Pearson correlation coefficient. The Pearson correlation coefficient is a measurement of the linear correlation between two variables. R is also always between negative 1 and positive 1. The closer the absolute value of R is to 1, the stronger the linear correlation between the two variables. Variance is how much the measured values differ from the average value in the data set. A positive R value means positive correlation, meaning as one variable increases, the other increases. This would be like the more you smoke, the more you get lung cancer. Negative R value would be a negative correlation. As one variable increases, the other decreases. And this would be like, as it increases, the other decreases. I don't know, but you know the vibe. Coefficient of determination is R squared. It is the proportion of variance in one variable that can be explained by variance in the other. Correlation does not imply causation. Nice. Okay, so no correlation, R equals zero. A weak negative correlation, and then one is like the best it can be. R is always between negative one and positive one. Negative one being a strong negative correlation and positive one being a strong positive correlation. So I'm just gonna like read the list that they have, like examples. So an R of negative 0.8 would show a strong negative correlation. R equals negative 0.4 is a weak negative correlation. R equals 0 is no correlation. R equals positive 0.4 is a weak positive correlation. R equals positive 0.8 is a strong positive correlation. Okay, that was biostats. Next time we'll do bioethics. Yay!